Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the power of positive thinking, and how is it that so many of us engage in glass-half-full self-coaching when we think we're just being realistic? As it turns out, a significant majority of us not plagued by depression tend to unwittingly trick ourselves into believing the best is yet to come. So we underestimate the chances our marriages will break up, overestimate the ages at which we will likely die, and assume a whole range of bad outcomes simply can't happen to us. But while it might seem like all that Pollyanna thinking could lead us astray, my guest today is convinced our tendency to accentuate the positive is a gift of evolution and has played a major role in human ambition and progress. Neuroscientist Tali Sherratt is a research fellow at the Wellcome Trust Center for Neuroimaging at the University College London. Her new book is called The Optimism Bias, A Tour of the Irrationally Positive Brain. Tali, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
So the origins of this field of study for you might surprise people. You were in New York when 9/11 happened, and then you wanted to see how accurately people remembered the events of the day. Is that right?
So what I wanted to do was to see whether the same structures in the brain, which are important for how people remember past traumatic events, are also important when people imagine future events. And it's true that when we first identified which regions of the brain are involved when you remember traumatic events of your, from your past, a study that we conducted was we had people in a brain imaging scanner so we could look at which parts of the brain are active at any point in time, and we asked them to remember events from 9/11 as well as events from about a few days before 9/11 or a few weeks before 9/11, which are just kind of ordinary events. And we looked at the differences at how the brain retrieves very traumatic events, very negative, very arousing events, versus what happens in the brain when you just retrieve ordinary memories like going to class, having a summer job, and so on. And so once we identified those regions, we were then interested to see whether the same regions are involved when you imagine future events, imagine negative events, traumatic events, everyday events. That was the goal of our study. And when we started that study, we found something very interesting, which was that even when we gave people very mundane, everyday events to imagine in the future, they tended to imagine these magnificent scenarios around them. So we give an example where we ask someone to imagine getting a haircut, and they would imagine something of a celebration. So the participant said, I imagine that I get my haircut to donate to Locks of Love, and then I go to celebrate with all my friends. And for riding a ferry, a person would imagine riding a ferry in the sun, and then their hair is blowing everywhere in the wind. And it was always these magnificent scenarios. And that was what I really caught my attention and made me think about why people imagine these very, very positive scenarios when they imagine the future. Is it that we're very optimistic? And if so, how is this optimism generated?
And even when people are asked to imagine something that would definitely be negative, they spend less time focusing on that than they do fantasizing about the good stuff.
Yeah, so what we tend to do is, it's not that we don't think about things that can be, you know, devastating in our future. We do think about those things, but we think of them less of the time. And when we do think of them, we don't think of them in as much detail. So when we ask people to imagine a positive event, such as winning an award or gaining a large sum of money, they would imagine these events in lots of detail, and they would imagine these events as if they're going to happen very, very soon. But when we ask them to imagine negative events, such as losing a large sum of money or going to a funeral or breaking up in a relationship, those events were not imagined with as much detail, and they were imagined as happening further away in the future. So people were kind of like pushing those events way into the future. Mm-hmm. And so they were a little bit more vague in their mind when they imagined them. And also what people tend to do is they tend to figure out how they would overcome a negative event. So, for example, when we ask someone to imagine getting stuck out of your apartment without the keys, what one girl imagined was that she would just go to the landlady and get the spare keys. So people would kind of figure out ways where a negative situation would end up not really being as that negative anymore.
Hmm. And the theory these days is that we likely evolved our optimism around the same time we became sophisticated enough to understand that, in fact, we would definitely die someday.
Yeah, so this is a theory. It's not for now, it's just more of a theoretical kind of assumption which evolutionary biologists have. And the idea is that once humans became conscious, once we gained consciousness and the ability to look far into the future, ability to really understand that we're one day going to die and all the things that are going to happen, you know, when we get older, well, the theory is that that realization on its own would have been very, very devastating, so much so that it would maybe have stopped the actions that we need to continue to survive. And so the theory goes that together with this realization and consciousness, a positivity bias had to arise. So the only way that people could become aware of you know, their future and the fact that they're not going to live forever was to generate these positive biases at the same time. So together with the understanding of death, there would be the denial of death. And so with this positivity bias, people would actually go ahead and the human race would develop. And maybe it seems that maybe optimism together with consciousness is really important for where we find humans today with all the developments that humans have achieved.
So, Tali, is the human belief in an afterlife a manifestation of optimism, like on steroids?
yeah, I would say that is the ultimate optimistic idea. And, you know, I think the religion and the idea of an afterlife taps into this very human need and tendency for optimism. It tells us that, you know, there's always something to look forward to and something positive at the end of the road.
We should step back here for a moment maybe and define optimism, because an optimistic outlook on life does not necessarily equate to a cheerful demeanor.
Yes. So happiness doesn't necessarily equal optimism. And it's really interesting because the real definition of optimism is simply positive expectations of the future. And it's not about expectations at the present. It's not about expectations or memories from your past. It's simply about having positive expectations of the future. And it doesn't mean that, you know, everyone who's optimistic is a smiley person and happy person, although there is a relationship. So optimism doesn't equal happiness, but optimism can generate happiness. So according to, you know, the way that I think about things is that if you expect things to be good, if you expect the future to be bright, that actually makes you happy at the moment. And there's an example that kind of really portrays it, which is, imagine that you're having dinner with your friends and family and, you know, having a nice dinner, but you know that tomorrow you're going to have to go to jail. How happy will you be? So you wouldn't be so happy, although at the moment everything seems to be perfect, but just the knowledge that tomorrow you're going to have to go to jail makes you unhappy at the present. Now let's imagine that you're sitting in a jail cell, it's cold and wet, but you know that tomorrow you're going to be released and you're going to have a dinner with your friends and family. How happy would you be? Well, you're going to be quite happy, even if at the moment you're cold, uncomfortable. Knowing that tomorrow you're going to be released and you're going to see your family makes you very happy. So what that means is that happiness is very much determined about from our expectations. Expecting positive events makes us happy. Now, it doesn't mean that what happens in the moment doesn't matter. It does matter. But I think that our expectations have a huge, huge effect on our mood and our state at the very present time.
Can you talk for a minute about the relationship between optimism or lack of optimism and depression?
Yeah. So with depression, what we see is that people who are mildly depressed, so clinically diagnosed as mildly depressed, they tend to be realistic. So they're the ones who actually can predict the future quite well. They're better at doing that than, you know, healthy, non-depressed individuals. Now you have the people who are severely depressed, they have a pessimistic bias. So they expect the future to be worse than it ends up being. And what we find when we look at the brain and we look at optimistic individuals, what we see is that the same brain regions that are important for optimism in healthy individuals are exactly the ones that are malfunctioned in depression. And that really ties the two together. We're kind of looking at two sides of the same coin. or a mirror image, if you will. On one side, we have the optimists, who are most of the population, as we said. And on the other side, we have the depressive, which are either realist or pessimistic, and their brain functions in a way that if you look at the opposite side, you'll see optimists. Activation in the brain in the same exact regions. Those are the regions that seem to be malfunctioning in depression.
And this is taking place in the hippocampus, is that right?
No. So the hippocampus is very important for memory, and they're also very important for imagining in general. So we need the hippocampus to remember our past, and we need the hippocampus to imagine our future. And if you have damage to your hippocampus, you are amnesic, and that means that you can't remember the past, but and interestingly enough, it also means that you have a very hard time predicting what you're going to do tomorrow, imagining what's going to happen next year. So that's the hippocampus. Now, the regions that are important for biasing our imagination in a positive way, the regions that are important for optimism are actually the amygdala. Amygdala is a small structure deep in the brain which is involved in processing emotional information. And regions of the frontal lobe. So frontal lobe is a part of our brain that has evolved late in evolution, and it is important for modulating activity of areas deep in the brain that are involved in emotion. So you can think of the frontal lobe, and especially this one part called the RACC, which is part of the frontal lobe, as a bit like a traffic conductor. So it enhances positive associations and positive emotions from below, from the amygdala and other regions that are important for motivation when you think about the future, in optimists. And in depressive, it seems not to be doing that. So it's if your traffic conductor is not working well if you're depressed.
So reading about people who are at least mildly depressed being the most realistic of all, it made me wonder whether there is some evolutionary benefit to having at least a small subset of the population being mildly depressed at any given time.
Yeah, well, I think I would assume that, yes, it's important to have at least realists. I wouldn't say we want depressive per se, but yes, what you're saying is that it might be important for a population as a whole to have realists as well. And this really taps into the negative sides of optimism, because there's a lot of positive sides, which is that optimism is related to better health, optimists live longer, optimism is related to better success in your professional careers. We see that optimists earn more. Economists at Duke found that they work harder and longer hours, therefore they earn more. And there's a lot of positive aspects that we can talk about later, but there are negative aspects as well, which is if we underestimate our risks, we might not take the precautionary actions needed to protect ourselves. So you can look at an individual level, which is, you might not go to medical screenings because you think you're going to be okay. You might not buy insurance. But on a bigger level, what we find is that optimism is actually responsible, for example, is one of the core reasons for the economic meltdown of 2008 for the credit crunch. So economists have named the optimism bias as one of the reasons for the credit crunch. And it also means that people tend to not plan quite well ahead. So again, on an individual level, it can be that you're going to renovate your house, you might not put enough money on the side for it. You might think that you're going to be done earlier than you are. But if we look at a bigger kind of scale, if we look at companies and governments, it's the same problem, that because of optimism, the plans are not really as accurate and as good as they should be. And so what the British government has done, for example, in what they call the Green Book, which is a book.
I'm so sorry, Tally. Let me jump in here. We need to take a quick break. Tally Sherritt is my guest. She's a neuroscientist at University College London. Her new book is called The Optimism Bias, A Tour of the Irrationally Positive Brain. Join the conversation now at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is neuroscientist Tally Sherritt. She's a research fellow at the Wellcome Trust Center for Neuroimaging at the University College London. Her new book is called The Optimism Bias, A Tour of the Irrationally Positive Brain. If you've got a question, you can call in now to 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. So before the break, Tally, you were telling us about the downsides, particularly in economic markets, to the optimism bias, and a response by, was it the British government?
Yeah, so what the British government has done is, in their Green Book, which is a book with recommendation for project appraisers, they state that there's an optimism bias, and all budgets for all of their different projects have to be adjusted for that. And so the 2012 Olympic budget has already been adjusted for the optimism bias, and it's one of the first Olympics in a very long time which is actually on budget. Hmm. So, you know, I think to answer back to your question was, you know, is it good on a big scale to have realists among us? I think it's good. But the other option is to simply be aware. So if we investigate people's behavior and expectations, we can then become aware of these biases. And if we're aware of them, even as optimists, what we can do is to take them into account, right? So, you know, if you're budgeting for renovating your house, you can then add a little bit extra, given that you know that there's an optimism bias. If you think you're going to be done in a year, you should say, well, probably not quite realistic, given that we know that people usually underestimate how long it will take, and then add a little bit more to that.
Yeah, I was thinking, I don't know if you have kids, but when people imagine themselves as parents, you never imagine staying up all night with a screaming colicky baby or, you know, having some brand new outfit ruined. You think of all those sweet, snuggly moments, and realistically, you should consider both.
Yeah, and I think that's a good example, because that's an example where people actually do have quite a bit of information. So many people know, you know, other people who've had kids and all of their experiences, and you know, we have information online and books. And so you really have the information that you need, but still people say, oh, no, in my case it will be different, and then they focus on more of the positive. And, you know, maybe that's important for us to actually go ahead and do it and have kids.
Keep the human race going.
Yeah.
So, Tally, what role does optimism play in our ability to learn from the mistakes we do make?
So the thing with optimism is that it seems that having expectations that are not met means that we can learn from them more. So in a nice study by my colleague, Sarah Benston, what she did, she wanted to see how people's expectations of how well they'll do on a cognitive task will affect their end results, will affect how much they learn while doing the task. And she wanted to manipulate people's expectations. So what she did is she primed them with words such as clever and smart. So she kind of put those words on the screen. Or she put words such as dumb and stupid. So she'd either prime them with positive expectations or negative expectations. Next, she had them do these tasks. So it's like IQ kind of tasks. Mm-hmm. And what she found was that people who were primed with the word clever, when they did an error, when they did a mistake on one of the questions, what she found was an enhanced activity in their frontal lobes in response to that error. And she also found that they then learned better from that error. So next time, they're less likely to make it. And our brain, what it does really, it encodes errors. Anytime we're surprised, our expectation is not met, our brain goes wild. Activity is enhanced, and it's telling us, look, 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 something's not quite right. It's not quite what you expected. And we learn from those signals. They're really, really important. But when she primed people with words such as stupid, when they did a mistake, there wasn't such enhanced activation because they expected to do well. You know, they primed them with stupid. They expected to do poorly. And so when they did an error, the error, you know, they weren't surprised. They were like, well, I'm not expecting to do well. And no activation enhancement, and therefore they also didn't do as well at the end of the day because they just didn't learn from the mistakes.
On the other hand, it's been well documented that people, even after something bad happens to them, look high and low for a silver lining to whatever terrible has just befallen them.
Yes, absolutely. So what we find is that even negative events very negative events, such as getting fired or having an illness, when those events happen to us, we don't expect them, but when it actually happens to us, what we tend to do after the first shock is to try to find a silver lining. So if you just got fired after the initial shock, you might say to yourself, well, this might give me an opportunity to find a better job. The last one wasn't so great because of blah, blah, blah. And or maybe I could go back to school for a while or go traveling. So you try to find the positive aspects. And it's true even in illnesses. So if you look at, for example, Lawrence Armstrong, he says that he values having cancer because it made him into a better man and a better father. So people find the positive aspects in everything. And this is important because it means that it's easier for us to cope.
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise, it would just be devastating.
Like, why me, as opposed to, well, this is not so bad, it could have been worse.
Yeah, or at least see the positive. I think at the beginning, at the first initial reaction is always shock, and depending on how bad the situation is, there's a little bit of anger and so on. But then quite quickly, people change their views and try to find the positive in anything that befalls them.
So you alluded to this earlier. We have an email here from Steve in Dallas who wants to know about optimists living longer. What's up with that?
Yeah, so this is really interesting. So there's been many studies. I'll tell you about one. This one study surveyed 100,000 women for 15 years, from the age of 50 until they were 65. And they found that optimistic females were 14% less likely to die and 30% less likely to die from cardiac arrest. This was also shown in males with cardiac arrest patients and AIDS patients and cancer patients. So they showed that pessimistic cancer patients were more likely to die within 7 months than non-pessimistic ones, all else being equal. So then the question is, why is it? Why are optimistic people less likely to die? Why are they more healthy? Well, the answer is that if you expect positive events in your future, stress and anxiety is reduced. And we know that stress and anxiety, if we reduce them, that's better for our health, because stress is not good for our health. So that's one reason. The second reason is that if you expect to be healthy, you expect to recover from whatever condition you have, you're more likely to take the actions needed to recover. So it's been shown that optimists are more likely to take vitamins, they're more likely to follow the doctor's order, to exercise, and these actions then lead to positive outcomes.
What criteria in a clinical setting allow you to classify someone as an optimist or a pessimist?
Yeah, so there's a few different methods, and the good news is that they usually converge. So the first method is a very simple one. It's simply a questionnaire with about 10 questions, out of which 6 tells us if you're optimistic or not. And the questions are very simple. It's something like, do you agree with the following sentences? I always expect good things in my future. I think things are going to turn out my way. So very, very kind of straightforward. And you'd think that such a straightforward questionnaire would not give you much, but it's been used for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of studies, and it correlates with everything else that you'd think it would correlate with optimism. So this is one measure, but usually it's a good idea to use another measure, to make sure that you're tapping into what you want to be tapping into. And so what we usually do is we contrast expectations with outcome. So, for example, in one study what we did is we had people come in and we asked them, we gave them all types of different events that might happen to them in the next month, such as, for example, getting stuck in traffic, burning your dinner, seeing a movie that you like, seeing a movie that you don't like, getting a gift. And we asked them, what is the likelihood of all these events happening to you in the upcoming month? And at the end of the month, we had them come back and tell us which events happened and which did not happen. So what we can do is we can contrast people's expectations with what actually happened to them. And what we found was that for most people, they expected positive events to happen to them with a great likelihood. So they would say over 50% for positive events happening in the next month. But for negative events or just neutral, boring events, they thought, oh, maybe 33% chance. So they didn't think that they were as likely. But when they came back at the end of the month, they told us that actually all these events, positive, negative, and neutral, were as likely to happen as each other. So it's not that they were leading very charmed life. They simply had an optimism bias. So that's a very good method. You could always contrast people's expectations, you know, how likely are you to get cancer, to get a divorce, with some kind of objective measure of how likely they are or what actually happened to them.
Americans tend to think that this is a special American quality, that we are more optimistic than people in other parts of the world. You've discovered that is, in fact, not the case.
Yeah, and it's not just me. So there's been studies all over the world, really. And it's true that most people think, oh, you know, Americans, yeah, they're optimists. But, you know, if I give talks in Europe or in the Middle East, they're like, yeah, but we're not really optimistic as these just Americans. Huh. And, you know, it's something that Obama invented. But optimism is found all over the place. So I've conducted experiments in the U.S., in Germany, in the U.K., in Israel. And all over these countries, you always find the same thing. And other people have looked at other countries as well, and it's quite a global phenomena. It's not something that's unique for Americans. It's not something that's unique for a specific race. It's not something that's unique for a specific gender. It's not even something that's unique for a specific age. So we find that very young children are optimistic, you know, when they play what's going to happen when I grow up, what am I going to be? But also older adults seem to be as optimistic as younger adults.
Is our optimism bias pretty personal? In other words, do we assume good things are going to happen to us, but not necessarily to everybody else on our block?
Absolutely. So optimism seems to be about me, about my family, about my kids. But it's not when you think about optimism, you're not very optimistic about the other citizens. You're not optimistic about the country as a whole. Actually, we seem to be pessimistic somewhat about where the country is going, where our leaders are going, about the future of our fellow citizens. And quite interestingly, it seems that in Asia, it's not quite so. So when I said that optimism is quite global, at first, when there were first studies done in Asia, in Eastern cultures, what they found was that it seemed like they were not optimistic, which was very surprising. How come in Asian countries, in Asian cultures, people are not optimistic? It didn't quite seem right. But then what they discovered is that in those countries, people are optimistic, but we're not really asking them the right question. So we were asking them, you know, how likely is it that your future will be bright? How long are you going to live? Blah, blah, blah. But really, the question that you should be asking in those countries is about the group. Because it's more of a group culture, they were more optimistic about their group, about, you know, people in their village, about maybe the country, and not so much about the individual. But if you look at Western countries, there you find that people are optimistic about themselves, but not so much about the group.
What a fascinating difference. Talk about this. Is optimism contagious?
Is optimism contagious? That's a good question. I don't think there's a good answer to that. There's been some studies done by psychologists at Harvard and UC San Diego looking at whether happiness, for example, is contagious. And what they found was that happiness is contagious. So if someone is happy, what they find is that they can change the happiness of not only their friends, but also their friends of friends of friends. It's kind of a wave that goes. So we are affected not only by our friends, but people who are just friends of our friends and so on. But they cannot look at optimism. So that's something interesting to see. But I think if we think about the media and how optimism can be transferred in that way, it seems there's no studies that I know, but it seems to me likely that these type of information, places where we get our information and our expectations can affect our optimism, which is why, you know, I think Obama was very successful because he had his whole thing was about hope and about change, and it kind of really tapped into people's need for optimism at the time because it was quite a difficult time. And having that kind of message pumped again and again and again maybe actually, you know, became contagious somewhat.
So has anybody looked into whether or not optimists tend to be more popular than other people?
Ooh, I can't think of a specific study, so I don't know. You would assume they would probably be, because if we have the need for optimism and someone is giving us that message, then maybe they are. But I can't really say that I know of any data.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go on the phones now to Violet in Frisco. Hi, Violet.
Hi. I have a quick question. How your parents raised you, or like you were talking about Asia, and I was thinking about Tiger Moms and stuff, or, you know, whether you were brought up in a very, like, pessimistic, real, kind of honest way, like, oh, this, you know, you can't be an actor, you know, the chances of being in the arts is very slim, and you won't make any money, or you can't do that, you know, something like that. Does that affect a person's optimism for the rest of their life, or?
Let's find out. What do you know about that, Tally?
Okay. Well, there's two things that are important here. And the first thing, actually, I'm going to answer you by telling you about an experiment about birds, and you'll see the connection. So the bird, what they wanted to see is whether birds are optimistic or not. And they did a very sophisticated way to see whether birds are optimistic. I'll tell you how they did it, and then the results relates to whether the birds were in a good or bad environment and how they were treated. So they wanted to know whether birds were optimistic. And what they did was they had the birds learn that when they hear a short tone, like that, they're going to get food straight away. So it was a positive reward, a good outcome, and the birds were quite happy. But they also taught them that when they hear a long tone, like that, they would have to wait for their food, wait for their reward. They weren't that happy, because it's a bit like we're going to a restaurant, we don't get our table, and we have to wait around, so they're not that happy.
Mm-hmm.
Then they wanted to see what happens when they get a medium tone, like not very short, not very long, somewhere in the middle. What would they expect? Would they expect a positive reward straight away, meaning that they are quite optimistic, or would they expect they have to wait for their reward?
Once again, let me jump in here. We need to take another quick break.
Okay.
My guest is Tally Sherritt. She's a neuroscientist at University College London. Her new book is called The Optimism Bias, A Tour of the Irrationally Positive Brain. We'll resume our conversation in a moment. You're welcome to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Tally Sherritt. She is a research fellow at the Wellcome Trust Center for Neuroimaging at University College London and author of the new book, The Optimism Bias, A Tour of the Irrationally Positive Brain. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org. Before the break, Tally, in answering Violet's question about the lifelong impact of parenting on levels of optimism, you were telling us about these hungry birds. A short tone means they're going to eat soon. A long tone means they're going to have to wait. And a researcher wanted to know what would happen with that medium tone.
Right. And what they found that is most birds, so what they did is they had a short tone, and the birds learned that when they have a short tone, they have to press a blue lever in order to get an immediate reward. And if they had a long tone, they'd had to press a red lever, and then they would get the delayed reward, which they didn't like so much. But they had to get it right. So they had to press the blue lever for a short one and the red one for a long one. Otherwise, they would get nothing. So they are motivated to do it correctly. So then they gave them a medium tone to see what happens. And what they found was that the birds pressed the blue lever, meaning that they expected a positive reward, meaning that they were optimistic, although there was no reason for them to be optimistic. But what was interesting was that not all the birds acted this way. So only birds that were housed in large cages, were given lots of toys and frequent water, they showed the optimism bias. But the birds in smaller cages with not so much water and not so much toys, they did not show this bias. They were more realistic, a bit like depressed individuals, like the mildly depressed individuals who are what we call depressive realism. So what that means is that your environment does have an effect on how optimistic you are. This is in birds, but we would imagine that the same principles apply. So that's one thing, that yes, if you are living in one environment versus the other, you might be more optimistic if you're living in a more positive, more enriching environment. The other question is whether our parents are optimistic or pessimistic. Does that make us more optimistic or pessimistic? Well, one answer to that is that we know that genetics are related to optimism. So if you have a specific type of gene, then you're more likely to be optimistic. And, you know, so in that case, that would mean that if our parents are more or less optimistic, that would make us more or less optimistic as well, just by thinking about how the genes work. Whether, other than that, our parents' attitude has an effect on our optimistic-pessimistic account, I don't know. So what we do know is your environment matters, we know your genes matters. Your specific way of parenting effects on children, I don't quite know.
Does optimism play a role in our resilience when empirically bad things do happen to us?
Yes. Yeah, so we talked before about how we tend to reevaluate our different options in a positive way. So when we have something negative happen to us, we tend to reevaluate it in a positive way, try to find the silver lining, you know, what, where can we find the opportunity within this negative event? And it seems that optimistic people do that more. We had a study where we had people rate different faces in terms of how attractive they were. And then we had them pick between two pairs of faces that were rated the same, on with which one do you want to go on a date with. And what we found was that when we gave people two low-rated individual faces, so people who were rated as not attractive, and we told the person, well, you're going to have to go on a date with one of these people. So they had to choose a non-attractive face out of two non-attractive faces. And what we found was, after that, we asked them to rate all faces again. And what we found was that people who are more optimistic tended, after they chose a non-attractive face, tended to rate those as more attractive. So they would reevaluate in the best possible way that they could. So although they said, oh, this is not an attractive person, once they chose them as one that they would go on a date with, they would make them in their minds as being more attractive.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next caller is Sue in Southlake. Hello, Sue.
Hello. I'd like to know, in your expert's opinion, what she thinks that is the difference between the study that she has done and the power of mind over the body studies.
Tally, were you able to hear that?
So, I mean, I think a lot of the examples that we gave today suggest that there is a lot of power of our mind over our body. So if we think, for example, of what we talked about, how optimism affects our health, right? So we said if you have positive expectations, we know that that makes you more likely to be healthy because we know it reduces stress, and we know that it makes you more likely to take the actions needed to become healthy. And that's one example of how our expectations or our mindset affects our health. And we know also that positive expectations make you more likely to take the actions needed to get your goals, whatever those goals are, if it's professional goals or goals within relationships or anything. If you have positive expectations, you're more likely to take the actions to get there. So I think that means that our mindset has quite a strong effect on our bodies and also on our actions and therefore on our future.
So I'm curious about this. Recently, we've done interviews that were about biographies of some famous people, including Clarence Darrow, the famous attorney, and the guy who designed Central Park. And in both cases, they were major risk takers. But they, you know, in their careers, they both invested in gold mines that went bad, things like that. But they were also very successful. I mean, is there a relationship between risk-taking behavior and also achievement in people who are optimistic?
Well, because optimism means that you underestimate the risks, that would also mean that you're more likely to take them. So optimists indeed are probably more likely to take risks. And I think the only way to really achieve great things is to take the risk.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes it backfires. You know, so you just gave an example of someone who both, you know, invested in bad stocks, but also ended up building Central Park or,
yeah.
you know, having like very positive achievements. So maybe that, you know, that could be a mechanism, one of the mechanisms why we find that optimists are more successful. So they work harder and try to fight for what they want, but they also take the risks. And again, sometimes it backfires, but sometimes it doesn't.
We've mentioned a couple of times during this hour that optimists are less likely to believe that they will be divorced despite the statistics. Are optimists also more likely to marry?
So they are more likely to remarry.
Huh.
Not less likely to divorce, but more likely to remarry. And again, it's another kind of example of how, you know, you have something negative happen to you, something that you didn't expect or you didn't want, such as divorce, but then you kind of think to yourself, okay, next time it will be better. Maybe I will learn from what went wrong last time to make my next relationship work, to make my next marriage work.
The triumph of optimism over experience.
Indeed.
Mm-hmm. So how do we know if we are optimistic to a point that we might actually get ourselves in trouble and not plan accordingly or not take precautions that are necessary?
Well, what scientifically people do, they kind of divide people into mild optimists and extreme optimists, and there's different ways to measure this. For example, a couple of economists at Duke, what they did was they looked at how long people expect to live,
mm-hmm.
and then they calculated how long they're likely to live based on all kinds of information that they had. And they would say that extreme optimists are people who estimate their longevity by 20 years or more above what would really be expected from them.
Wow.
And most of us overestimate how likely we're going to live in about 5 years. So people who are really, you know, extreme, that's those people who are overestimating by 20 years or more. And so you can, I mean, there's tests that you can take to measure how optimistic you are. The scale that I talked about before, we're just asking questions, and we can identify people who are extremely optimistic. But I think in general, I mean, it's good to be aware, even if we're a mild optimist, it's good to be aware that we have this optimism bias so we can take the precautionary action. You know, be aware that we're probably not going to medical screenings as often as we should do because we think everything is going to be okay. But the good thing is you can expect to be healthy but still go to medical screenings anyway. I mean, you could expect to everything would be okay but still buy insurance or health insurance or all of that. So even if you're a mild optimist, it's good to have the knowledge of this optimism bias and then take some actions to protect yourself.
In the beginning of the hour, we talked about the relationship between memory and imperfect recall of memory and the ability to imperfectly but very optimistically imagine the future. Do people who are optimistic also tend to look back on the past and sort of edit out what was less pleasant?
Yeah, we don't actually have any indicators to suggest that that's necessarily true. I think optimism, it's mainly about the future. It's a little bit about the present and a little bit less about the past. And I think the difference is that the future is wide open. There's no constraints and, you know, anything could actually happen. And that kind of scenario really plays into our hope. But when you look into the past has already happened, and there's nothing much that we could change. So optimists are not necessarily the ones to change the way that they remember the past. We do have some indication that people have positive biases in the way that they look at the present. So a very nice study, two psychologists have shown that when people are about to climb a hill, and they had them climb a hill on all fours and something very difficult, they found that the people who are about to climb a hill, they would underestimate the slope.
Mm-hmm.
So they would try to look at it as a more positive way. Or in another study, they had people dress up as Cameron Miranda, so with kind of a skirt from and a fruit hat, and, you know, the Cameron Miranda kind of clothes. And they asked them to walk across the green in campus in those clothes. So quite embarrassing. So students had to do this. It was quite embarrassing for them. Mm-hmm. And they asked them to estimate how long the lawn was. So how long would they have to walk, you know, from here to there? How long do you think? What is a distance? And what they found was that people hugely underestimated the distance. So they kind of saw the world as they wanted to see it. They wanted to see it as shorter so they wouldn't have to be embarrassed for a longer time, right? So that's another indication that even the way that we see the present has some positivity biases. But it's really important when we look into the past to remember both the good and the bad so we can learn from it. And I think that's important. I mean, it's important to know bad things may have happened, negative things may have happened. We may have had, you know, failed in specific things. We may have gone through heartaches. But if we can learn from those, if we can remember them and then learn from those, that actually is an optimistic thing because that means maybe next time we can do better.
It sounds like you've got to have very optimistic people on your research team in order to recruit people to undertake these experiments as subjects.
Oh, the ones with Cameron Miranda?
Yeah.
Or in general,
here's what you're going to do, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I guess maybe they got a kick out of it, right? How fun is it to like, dress people up like that and have them walk around the lawn? Yeah. But, yeah, it's quite amazing that people would agree to do that for you know, a pay of a few dollars or so. Yeah.
Is it possible to consciously switch off our optimism temporarily in order to understand certain decisions we have to make in entirely realistic terms, or is this something that is completely beyond our control?
I think we don't switch optimism off, but we can have optimistic expectations and at the same time know that they're optimistic.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, our mind has different networks in it. And so at any given moment, we often have different thoughts and different feelings. And those thoughts and feelings are many times in conflict, but we have them at the same time. And it's the same thing with optimism. We don't necessarily switch it off. I don't think, you know, if you're optimistic, I don't think you can make yourself consciously less optimistic. You can't tell yourself, oh, don't be so optimistic. I mean, if this is what you feel and this is what you expect, that's what you expect. But you can at the same time be aware that this may be a bias and then tell yourself, okay, I need to take these and those actions as well at the same time because to just, you know, be on the safe side.
Neuroscientist Tally Sherritt is a research fellow at the Wellcome Trust Center for Neuroimaging at University College London. Her new book is called The Optimism Bias, A Tour of the Irrationally Positive Brain. Tally, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Thank you for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.